This is the Man of God Podcast, a broadcast that is brought to you by Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary in Owensboro, Kentucky. Today, I want to discuss for about half an hour the history of the Salem witch trials of 1692 as they are a reflection upon Cotton Mather. And to your surprise, if you don't know this history, to vindicate Cotton Mather that he wasn't actually involved in the Salem witch trials. When I was teaching American church history in a little church plant that we had started up, the night before, and I'd been studying for a week to do the Salem witch trials as part of the early American history, up until 24 hours before, I was sure that Cotton Mather was involved in the Salem witch trials because everything written from 1831 on implicated him in the trials. But the last day that I had time to study this out further, including Sunday morning because we had a later service in most churches, I discovered two books that really vindicated Cotton Mather from being involved at all in the Salem witch trials, and those two sources are William Poole and Enoch Pond. My purpose of doing this is to show, if you're interested in teaching church history, and I would say especially American church history, try to go back as close as you can, now that we have the opportunity to do this through books.google.com and finding sources, archive.org and other places, and do firsthand research and find out to see if there's been any revisionist history between then and now. With that, we'll start today's podcast. The following article was in the North American Review for April of 1869, written by William Frederick Poole, who actually lived in Salem, Massachusetts. Cotton Mather and the Salem Witchcraft Trials. This is a vindication of Cotton Mather, and to show that Cotton Mather was not involved in the Salem Witch Trials, and that to state that he was is a revisionist history. Nearly two centuries have passed away since the saddest tragedy of early New England history was enacted at Salem and Salem Village. Instead of fading out from the memory of men, the incidents of Salem witchcraft are receiving more attention today than at any former period. The fact of its being the last great exhibition of a superstition which had cursed humanity for thousands of years, and that every incident connected with it has been preserved in the form of record, deposition, or narrative, imparts to it a peculiar interest, and one which will be permanent. It is not as a record of horrors, but as a field of psychological study that the subject will retain its hold on the minds of men. More victims than suffered at Salem were hurried to the gallows by witchcraft year after year in a single county of England during the 17th century. But the details of English trials, then so common, were generally not thought worth preserving. Probably as much authentic and reliable information respecting the Salem proceedings is extant as of the trials of the 30,000 victims who suffered from the same cause in England. How did the Salem delusion originate? Who was responsible for it? Was it wholly the result of fraud and deception, or were there psychological phenomena attending it which have never been explained? Is there any resemblance between the proceedings of the afflicted children of Salem Village and modern spiritual manifestations? Were the clergy of New England or any other profession or class in the community especially implicated in it? Any one of these questions affords a theme for discussion. We propose, however, to review the incidents of this fearful tragedy for the purpose of re-examining the historical evidence on which, in the popular estimation, so large a portion of the culpability for those executions has been laid upon one individual. In 1831, Charles Wentworth Upham printed his lectures on Salem witchcraft, in which he brought some very grave charges against Cotton Mather as being the contriver, instigator, and promoter of the delusion, and the chief conspirator against the lives of the sufferers. These charges have been repeated by Mr. Quincy in his History of Harvard University, by Mr. Peabody in his Life of Cotton Mather, by Mr. Bancroft, and by nearly all historical writers since that date. Mr. Upham, after an interval of 36 years, has reiterated and emphasized his original accusations in his elaborate history of Salem witchcraft printed in 1867. They have obtained a lodgment in all the minor and school histories, and the present generation of youth has taught that 19 innocent persons were hanged and one was pressed to death to gratify the vanity, ambition, and stolid credulity of Cotton Mather. If one imagines that we are stating the case too strongly, let him try an experiment on the first bright boy he meets by asking, "Who got up Salem witchcraft?" And with a promptness that will startle him, he will receive the reply, "Cotton Mather." Let him try another boy with the question, "Who was Cotton Mather?" And the answer will come, "The man who was on horseback and hung witches." An examination of the historical textbooks used in our schools will show where these ideas originated. We have the latest editions of a dozen such manuals before us, but the following examples must suffice. Quote, "Cotton Mather, an eccentric but influential minister, took up the matter, and great excitement spread through the colony. Among those hanged was a minister named Burroughs, who had denounced the proceedings of Mather and his associates. At his execution, Mather appeared among the crowd on horseback and quieted the people with quotations from Scripture. Mather gloried in these judicial murders," end quote. Quackenbos's School History of the United States, 1868, pages 138 to 140. From Lossing's Pictorial History of the United States, 1868, page 106, Cotton Mather and other popular men wrote in its defense. Caliph, a citizen of Boston, exposed Mather's credulity and greatly irritated the minister. Mather called Caliph a weaver-turned-minister, a coal from hell, and prosecuted him for slander, end quote. Well, due to my shortness of time in a single podcast, I can't read all of these quotes, but I go on to quote Mr. Poole. Mr. Bancroft adopts substantially the views of Upham. Cotton Mather's boundless vanity gloried in the assaults of evil angels upon the country. To cover his own confusion, he got up a case of witchcraft in his own parish. Was Cotton Mather honestly credulous? He is an example how far selfishness under the form of vanity and ambition can blind the higher faculties, stupefy the judgment, and dupe consciousness itself. But we need not pause over Mr. Bancroft's second-hand and rhetorical statements. Mr. Hildreth gave some attention to the original authorities and saw that the wild assertions of Mr. Upham and Mr. Bancroft were untenable. It is to be regretted that with his candid and impartial methods of study, he did not go far enough to reach the whole truth. He says, "The suggestion that Cotton Mather, for purposes of his own, deliberately got up this witchcraft delusion and forced it upon a doubtful and hesitating people is utterly absurd. Mather's position, convictions, and temperament alike called him to serve on this occasion as the organ, exponent, and stimulator of the popular faith," end quote. These views respecting Mr. Mather's connection with the Salem trials are to be found in no publication of a date prior to 1831, when Mr. Upham's lectures were published. The clergy of New England, indeed, soon after the delusion abated and subsequently had been blamed for fostering the excitement, and increased Mather and Cotton Mather, father and son, being the most prominent clergymen in the colony, both staunch believers in the reality of witchcraft and writers on the subject, were criticized more freely than any others. But these charges were very different from those we are to consider. Mr. Upham, in the appendix to his second edition, printed in 1832, sets forth and maintains for his opinions a claim of originality to which he is entitled. The accuracy of his statements respecting Mr. Mather's character had been questioned. Mr. Upham, in his reply, admits that previously to the investigation of the subject of his lectures, quote, "a shadow of a doubt had never been suggested respecting Mr. Mather's moral and Christian character," end quote. He adds, quote, "It was with the greatest reluctance that such a doubt was permitted to enter into my mind. It seemed incredible, nay, almost impossible, that a man who had been at the head of all the great religious operations of his day, who had been the instrument of so many apparent conversions, and who devoted so many hours and days and weeks of his life to fasting and prayer, could in reality be dishonest and corrupt. But when the evidence of the case required me to believe that in the transactions which I had undertaken to relate, his character did actually appear in this dark and disgraceful light, a regard for truth and justice compelled me to express my convictions," end quote. In this discussion, we shall treat Mr. Upham's lectures and history in the same connection, as the latter is an expansion and defense of the views presented in the former. In the history, Cotton Mather appears more frequently and in a more favorable light than in the lectures, and many of the allusions to him are not referred to in the index. He comes in when we should least expect him, and always with evil purpose, plotting and counterplotting, disappointed when the trials were over, planning new excitement and other trials in Boston, unrepentant when everybody else had taken to the confessional, wrecked in reputation almost before his career had commenced, and going to his grave full of remorse and disappointment. But William Poole says of Upham's research, quote, "Mr. Upham is never at a loss to know what Mr. Mather contemplated on any occasion, what he longed for, what he would have been glad to have, what he looked upon with secret pleasure, and what he was secretly and cunningly endeavoring to do. Mr. Peabody also knows when Cotton Mather was in his element, and what he enjoyed the great felicity of. We do not hope to follow these writers into the dark recesses of Mr. Mather's mind, but in the course of this investigation we shall take up some of their statements and examine them in the light of evidence that may be regarded as historical." A few words touching the widespread belief in witchcraft prevalent in the 17th century may prepare some of our readers better to appreciate the events which are more particularly to come under our notice. No nation, no age, no form of religion or irreligion may claim an immunity from this superstition. The reformers were as zealous in this manner as the Catholics. It is estimated during the 16th and 17th century 200,000 persons were executed, mostly burned in Europe, Germany furnishing one half of the victims, and England 30,000. We are soon to consider the credulity and superstition of Cotton Mather, and desire here to call attention to the not entire absence of these qualities in the staid and judicious John Winthrop, the founder of the Massachusetts colony. The facts in relation to Margaret Jones seem to be that she was a strong-minded woman with a will of her own, and undertook with simple remedies to practice as a female physician. Were she living in our day, she would brandish a diploma of M.D. from the New England Female Medical College, would annually refuse to pay her city taxes unless she had the right to vote, and would make speeches at the meetings of the Universal Suffrage Association. Her touch seemed to be attended with mesmeric powers. She made anise seed and good liquors do the work of huge doses of calomel and Epsom salts or their equivalents. Her predictions as to the termination of cases treated in the heroic method proved to be true. However, the regulars pounced upon her as a witch, as the monks did upon Faustus for printing the first edition of the Bible, put her and her husband into jail, set rude men to watch her day and night, subjected her person to indignities unmentionable, and with the assistance of John Winthrop and the magistrates, hanged her, and all of this only 15 years before Cotton Mather, the credulous, was born. Mary Johnson was executed the same year in Hartford. Mary Parsons was tried in 1651 and again in 1674. Her husband, Hugh Parsons, was tried in 1652. In 1651, two persons were tried in Hartford. In 1653, Goodwife Knapp was hanged at Fairfield, Connecticut, and so on. Mr. Peabody says, quote, "After the execution of Mrs. Hibbins in 1656, the taste for such scenes had abated, and it was not until Cotton Mather in 1685 published an account of several cases of witchcraft that such fears and fancies revived," end quote. But though we have given only an incomplete sketch of the early witch proceedings in New England, it is enough to show that the colonies were in a constant ferment from supposed diabolical agency for more than 40 years before 1692. In every community there were suspicious and accusations which never came to a public examination. The same disturbance had existed to a still greater extent in England and throughout Europe, with persons actuated simply by malice, the easiest method of annoying a neighbor, or of ridding a community of a pestilent old woman, was by setting on foot a charge of witchcraft against them. English books relating to the subject were very numerous, and constituted the light reading of the day. Everybody knew how a witch ought to behave, and some of their pranks afforded young people of unregenerate minds agreeable recreation after their unsavory tasks over the Cambridge platform and the Westminster Confession of Faith. On such reasoning, it will readily be seen that witch trials would be very infrequent and very harmless affairs. And yet these writers, judged by our modern standards, were very credulous and superstitious persons. The narrative we have quoted from John Winthrop's journal would not have seemed to them absurd or revolting. No intelligent person in those times rejected the theory of diabolical agency unless he rejected also the authority of the Old and New Testaments, the existence of angels, and a life beyond the grave. A belief in witchcraft was essential to the maintenance of a Christian character. To express any doubts on the subject was to lay oneself open to denunciation as a Sadducee, a term of reproach which had lost the significance it then had. No one within the pale of the Christian Church had then written or spoken against the reality of witchcraft. By taking an individual of a past generation out of his relations with his own times, and putting him upon the background of modern civilization and refinement, and then reproaching him with opinions and practices now shown to be erroneous, but which he shared in common with all of his contemporaries, it is very easy to make any character appear ridiculous and even culpable. But this is not the historical method of dealing with the reputations of men of a former age. We of the present shall need a more charitable interpretation of our own opinions and acts on the part of those who follow us. Did the man act well his part with the light he had? Did he, in a time of intense excitement, when life and reputation were at stake, act with reference to his duty to God and in charity to his fellow men? We have set forth some minuteness the theories of such writers as Perkins and Bernard, because we are to meet with these names as authorities in the progress of our investigation. When the governor and council asked the advice of the clergy of Boston and the vicinity in June 1692, those ministers advised, and Cotton Mather drew up the advice, that there is need of very critical and exquisite caution, and recommended, quote, that the directions given by such judicious writers as Perkins and Bernard may be observed, end quote. Both the Mathers adopted the theory of these writers and frequently made references to and quotations from them. But we shall recur to this manner in another connection. We now come to consider the first case of witchcraft in which Cotton Mather was concerned, and of which Mr. Upham says, quote, there is reason to believe that it originated the delusion of Salem, end quote. As the case is one of much importance, we shall allow Governor Hutchinson, who knew some of the parties concerned, and had conversed with others who were eyewitnesses, to relate the main incidents. Quote, in 1688 began a more alarming instance than any which had preceded it. Four of the children of John Goodwin, a grave man and a good liver at the north part of Boston, were generally believed to be bewitched. I had often heard persons who were of the neighborhood speak of the great consternation it occasioned. The children were all remarkable for ingenuity of temper, had been religiously educated, and were thought to be without guile. The eldest was a girl of 13 or 14 years. She had charged a laundress, one Glover, with taking away some of the family linen. The mother of the laundress was one of the wild Irish of bad character and gave the girl harsh language, soon after which she fell into fits, which were said to have something diabolical in them. One of her sisters and two brothers followed her example, and it is said were tormented in the same part of their bodies at the same time, although kept in separate apartments and ignorant of each other's complaint. Sometimes they would be deaf and dumb and blind, and sometimes all these disorders together would come upon them. Their tongues would be drawn down their throats and pulled out upon their chins. Their jaws, necks, shoulders, elbows, and all their joints would appear to be dislocated, and they would make most piteous outcries of burnings, of being cut with knives, bead, and so on, and the marks of wounds were afterwards to be seen. The ministers of Boston and Charleston kept a day of fasting and prayer at the troubled house, after which the youngest child made no more complaints. The others persevered, and the magistrates then interposed, and the old woman was apprehended. But upon examination would neither confess nor deny, and appeared to be disordered in her senses. Upon the report of physicians, she was executed, declaring at her death the children should not be relieved. The eldest after this was taken into a minister's, Mr. Mather's, family, where at first she behaved orderly, but after some time fell into her fits. The account of her affliction is in print, Mather's Memorable Providences, 1689. some things are mentioned as extraordinary, which tumblers are taught every day to perform. Others are more natural, but it was a time of great credulity, end quote. History of Massachusetts, Volume 2, pages 24 to 26. In his lectures of 1831, which have given the cue to all subsequent writers, Upham states as a historical fact that the Goodwin case was, quote, brought about by his, Cotton Mather's, management, end quote. Now, if Mr. Upham had not read the little evidence there is in this case, he was chargeable with a negligence and recklessness of statement, which we do not like to characterize, and thus assailing the reputation of a member of his own profession who was not living to make answer. If he had read the evidence, but the case is not a supposable one, no one who knows Mr. Upham will for a moment imagine that he would consciously make a misstatement or suppress any evidence which he deemed essential to a proper estimate of a character of which he was treating. We think it proper to make this explicit avowal here, for we shall often have occasion to question his facts and scrutinize his authorities as well as challenge his reasoning. There is no more unsafe and perilous task than the writing of history with a theory to maintain. If a preconceived opinion be strong and active, it must be controlled by no common love of truth and justice, not to render the person holding it disqualified even for the examination of authorities. Everything which comes under his eye only strengthens his opinion. The case seems to him so plain that he considers it unnecessary to look up rare and forgotten pamphlets and pore over musty manuscripts in the obscure chirography of two centuries ago for the purpose of verifying a date or explaining the motives of a person on whom he is to pass judgment. Mr. Upham can never have seen, quote, some few remarks upon a scandalous book by one Robert Caleff, in quote, Boston 1701, which was written by the parishioners of the Second Boston Church as a reply to Caleff's charges against Mr. Mather. Neither can he have seen, quote, some miscellaneous observations on the present debates respecting witchcrafts, in quote, 1692, nor increase Mather's cases of conscience concerning witchcrafts, 1693. For if he had seen these very important tracts, he would, with his integrity of purpose, have quoted from them the evidence to upset his whole theory. But he has read Cotton Mather's diary, which is full of penitential confessions and acknowledgments to himself and his Maker of manifold transgressions, of pride, vanity, hardness of heart, imprudent zeal, and unworthiness in his master's service. These confessions Mr. Upham regards as historical evidence. Such a use of the confessional, we believe, is not common with historical writers. Before such a touchstone, any devout man who keeps a diary will inevitably fall, since the more devout he is, the more self-deprecatory will be his confessions. Under this test, the apostles to the Gentiles himself becomes the chief of sinners. No historian has a moral right to assail the character of a man who bore a good reputation in his day without an exhaustive and candid examination of authorities. Such an examination we shall show that Mr. Upham has not made in the case of Cotton Mather, and that he has used the facts which have come under his observation with a strong bias against Mr. Mather as a man of integrity and veracity. Mr. Upham does not bring a particle of evidence or quote a single authority in proof of his allegations that the Goodwin case was brought about by Cotton Mather's management, end quote. An allegation which he accompanies by others equally unsupported. He says, quote, Dr. Cotton Mather aspired to be considered the great champion of the church and a most successful combatant against the prince of the power of the air. He seems to have longed for an opportunity to signalize himself in this particular kind of warfare and repeatedly endeavored to get up a delusion of this kind in Boston. An instance of witchcraft was brought about by his management in 1688. There is some ground for suspicion that he was instrumental in causing the delusion in Salem. At any rate, he took a leading part in conducting it, in quote, lectures, pages 106 and 107. The same statements and almost the same words he reproduces in his history, volume 2, page 366. Mr. John Goodwin, the father of the afflicted children, told the story of his domestic trials over his own name in Mather's memorable Providence of 1689, page 46. He describes how the first child was taken, then a second, and later two others. Friends were called in, and afterwards physicians, but no relief came. He then says, quote, "Now I, considering my affliction to be more than ordinary, it did certainly call for me more than ordinary prayer. I acquainted Mr. Allen, Mr. Moody, Mr. Willard, and Mr. Cotton Mather, the four ministers of the town, with it, and Mr. Morton of Charleston, earnestly desiring them that they, with some other praying people of God, would meet at my house, and there be earnest with God on the behalf of myself and my children," end quote. Did Cotton Mather have anything to do with the case before he was called in, with four other clergymen, after the affair had been going on for some time, and physicians and sympathizing friends had given no relief? Mr. Upham must show this, or his accusation fails. 12 years afterwards, Robert Califf, between whom and Mr. Mather a personal quarrel existed, and many bitter words had passed, published his More Wonders of the Invisible World, in which he says, page 152, quote, "Mr. Cotton Mather was the most active and forward of any minister in the country in these Goodwin matters, taking home one of the children and managing such intrigues with that child, and after printing such an account of the whole in his memorable providences, as conduce much to the kindling those flames that, in Sir William's time, threatened the devouring this country," end quote. We shall in another place speak of the value to be set upon Califf's statements respecting Mr. Mather. Soon upon Califf's book appeared, the parishioners of Mr. Mather took up this accusation, and in some few remarks, 1701, which Mr. Upham has never seen, proved it to be a downright falsehood. One of the seven persons who prepared the reply was John Goodwin, the father of the children. He makes over his own name a further statement, which we give entire. "Let the world be informed that, when one of my children had been laboring under sad circumstances from the invisible world for about a quarter of a year, I desired the ministers of Boston with Charleston to keep a day of prayer in my house, if so be deliverance might be obtained. Mr. Cotton Mather was the last of the ministers that I spoke to on that occasion, and though by reason of some necessary business he could not attend, yet he came to my house on the morning of that day and tarried about half an hour and went to prayer with us before any other minister came. Never before had I the least acquaintance with him. About 2 or 3 months after this, I desired that another day of prayer might be kept by the aforesaid ministers, which accordingly they did, and Mr. Cotton Mather was then present. But he never gave me the least advice, neither face to face, nor by way of epistles, neither directly nor indirectly. But the motion of going to the authority was made to me by a minister of a neighboring town now departed. And matters were managed by me in prosecution of the supposed criminal, wholly without the advice of any minister or lawyer or any other person. The ministers would now and then come to visit my distressed family and pray with and for them, among which Mr. Cotton Mather would now and then come and go to prayer with us. Yet all that time he never advised me to anything concerning the law or trial of the accused person. But after that wicked woman had been condemned about a fortnight, Mr. Cotton Mather invited one of my children to his house, and within a day or two after that, the woman was executed," end quote. John Goodwin. In vindication of Cotton Mather, the writers of some few remarks, which we said was from 1701, said, quote, "Now behold how active and forward Cotton Mather was in transacting the affairs relating to this woman, and be astonished that ever anyone should go to insinuate such things to the world as are known by most that ever heard of those afflicted children to be so far different from the truth," end quote. Cotton Mather, according to his custom with all prisoners, visited the Glover woman twice after her condemnation, not in the spirit of an inquisitor, but as a spiritual adviser. She never denied to him the guilt of witchcraft, but as to her confessions about confederacies with the devil, she only said that she used to be at meetings at which her prince and four more were present. She told him who the four persons were, and as to her prince, quote, her account plainly was that he was the devil, end quote. Cotton Mather asked her many questions, in reply to which, after a long silence, she said she would fain give full answers, but they would not let her. They? Who are they? She replied that they were her spirits or her saints. He advised her to break her covenant with hell. She answered that he spoke a very reasonable thing, but that she could not do it. He offered to pray with her and asked her to pray for herself. She replied that she could not unless her spirits would give her leave. However, Cotton Mather said, against her will, I prayed with her, which, if it were a fault, it was an excess of pity. Cotton Mather never revealed the names of the persons whom she or others accused, for he said, we should be very tender in such relation, lest we wrong the reputation of the innocent by stories not enough inquired into. I cannot resist a conviction, says Mr. Upham, quote, that he looked upon the occurrences and the Salem trials with secret pleasure and would have been glad to have had them repeated in Boston, end quote. Well, then why did not Cotton Mather divulge the names of the persons accused by the Glover woman? He had the matter entirely in his own hands and could have indulged a desire here ascribed to him to his heart's content. But we know he did not manifest such a spirit, and we are forced to inquire by what methods of historical investigation Mr. Upham proceeds when he makes such assertions without examination of the most important documents here adduced. Time we have for this podcast, but for further research, I recommend a book called The Mather Family by Enoch Pond, who was a professor of theology at Bangor Theological Seminary in the 19th century for 50 years. The three chapters that are worth reading are called Cotton Mather. Next, Cotton Mather continued, his alleged connection with excitement respecting witchcraft. And finally, Cotton Mather continued, his character vindicated. And between these two writings, you will have a very good defense of Cotton Mather that he wasn't at all involved in the Salem witch trials. But the last thing that I would bring forth as evidence is the diary of Cotton Mather. I brought up a copy at books.google.com where you could search the contents, and in no part of it did I find anything on the Salem witch trials because he wasn't involved. Well, thank you for tuning in to the Man of God podcast, a broadcast from Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary in Owensboro, Kentucky. This is the voice of the narrated Puritan, puritanaudiobooks.com.